AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Chevrolet, Chevy runs deep.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 137 for February 17th, 2012. Let me drive your business case. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern or 2400 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store.
Hey, everybody. It's great to have you back here on AutoLine After Hours with my paisano right here, Mr. De Lorenzo.
Buongiorno, Gianni.
It is good to be back with you.
It is.
But so what are we talking about?
Oh, well, we can start with cool stuff or the madness that's out there in the industry.
Cool. Let's start with the madness.
Of course. That's the best place to start. What Bob King, UAW president, going off the nut here, saying about how they're going to lead all these protests and everything like that.
Yes, they're going to conjure up the old days, and everyone's looking at their watches and saying that's not going to happen, Bob. I mean, he wants demonstrations, he wants civil disobedience, he wants arrests if they need to. He wants to align himself with the Occupy front. It's just like everyone's like, huh? What are you doing, Bob? What are you thinking?
Yeah, well, you know, when he goes off with that kind of rhetoric, it drives so many people away from the union. I don't think it's persuasive for companies, and that's where he's going to get more members, is going to after other companies. They don't want to hear this kind of stuff. They don't want to be associated with an organization like that. I don't understand why they don't get that, why they can't sell themselves in a better way than that.
Well, he keeps saying he wants to, unionize some of these implants or important
transplants. Good Freudian slip there, Peter.
And, but yeah, it's exactly right. It's just when they hear that, it's like, why would we even think about it? And the people working in the plants, we don't want to be associated with this guy. We want our jobs. We don't have time to be marching anywhere except to get our paychecks.
Well, you know, all this is going on. Here's Audi determining, you know, is it going to build a new plant in North America or what? Should it be in the U.S. or Mexico? It's going to Mexico, baby, and it ain't coming here.
No.
You know, especially not to anything that where they've got to deal with a union that talks like that.
Maybe Bob was, you know, just overwhelmed with the fact that those guys are trying to reopen the London Chop House, and he thought it was 1957 or something. I don't know.
Who knows? Who knows? Hey, well, we saw GM earnings today, and I think that it's a mixed bag. I mean, it's very impressive profits. I don't know if they actually cracked the barrier and broke the all-time record.
No, they didn't because of Europe.
Uh-huh. Well, that may have held them back, but if you look just in North America, the numbers were really impressive.
It's funny how really good product, you know, delivers profits.
It's, right.
Yeah.
And when you build them to market demand and not just try to force it down the customer's throat.
And GM has some great products, and they've cut their costs to nothing. And, so they're making money hand over fist in North America. And remember, it wasn't too long ago when North America was losing.
Oh, yeah.
Huge.
Massive amounts of money. Well, that's what's so amazing is to see. Certainly the North American operations, same thing's true at Ford, to go from all-time record losses only 2.5 years ago to all-time record profits.
Yeah.
It's just astonishing.
It is amazing. More amazing in Ford's case because they didn't have the quick rinse
right.
or whatever it was called.
That's right. That's it. That is what
you
it
know
is.
All those pensions? Never mind.
Yeah.
It's covered.
So. But there are downsides. I mean, still losing in Europe, GM is.
Well, they're perennially this fix for Opel. I don't think they're going to be able to do it.
Yeah. The other thing that I found amazing is they lost money in South America. And
which is a traditional stronghold.
Oh, yeah. That's them. Where, you know, they've cranked out big profits regularly. And now, even though their sales were up, they went from a pretty hefty profit to a loss. And to me, that's alarming. And it makes me wonder, is this a result of all the Chinese cars that are flooding into South America right now, that everyone's got to cut their prices? So even though they may be selling more vehicles, they're now losing money rather than minting it.
Well, all Dan Akerson hinted at in his statement was that we need to update our product portfolio there.
I wonder.
Yeah.
I was also interested to see that their profits were down in what they call their international operations, which is mainly China. But it went from, it still was profitable, but a not insignificant drop in profits, even though, again, car sales were up. So that tells me, another interesting thing that I figured out. In North America, GM earned roughly, from revenue, I'm not talking profits now, just from a sales standpoint, but they made about $29,000 on every vehicle that they sold. That's how much cash it brought in. In China, $6,000. So even though GM now sells a million more vehicles in China every year than in the U.S., it makes three times more profit in the U.S. I find these numbers very interesting.
Is it $2,900 or $29,000?
$29,000. The average vehicle that GM transacted in the United States was $29,000. In China, the average transaction was $6,000.
Because they're selling a lot of those three-wheelers or whatever those.
Well, I don't know that they're quite three-wheelers, but yeah, very inexpensive Wuling vans.
Mopeds.
They sell a lot of them.
Mopeds
right.
With balsa wood bodies and stuff.
Right.
Two mopeds joined in the balsa wood body.
So speaking of China, very interesting report out this week from the University of Tennessee saying, and they did this whole emissions thing, that they determined if China really goes heavily into electric cars, their emissions are going to go way up, not down.
Well, they're the king of the coal cars there.
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
It's all coal. And which transitions to the president wanting to throw even more money at the EV thing, right?
That's right. You can get a $7,500 tax credit right now if you buy an electric car. He wants to bump that up to $10,000, and I think he wants to add plug-in hybrids as well. So, you know.
And people still aren't buying them.
And they're still not. Craig Cole, as we were putting Daily together this morning, had a great line. He says, yeah, if it's not working, then do even more of it. I thought it was pretty
good.
Well,
that's our government. Yeah. Not all the time, but too often.
Another, also tying in, Ward's had an interesting article this week that EVs are not selling well in Europe at all. I mean, not at all. And as you know, Renault's pushing heavily into it. It's not the only one, but it's probably the leader in the field. In Europe, I don't think you can buy gasoline in any country over there for under $7 a gallon. I mean, you know, if ever there was a motivation to go out and get electric, you'd think $7 a gallon would do it. And yet they sold 11,500 electric passenger cars last year.
That's amazing.
It's nothing. That's nothing. That's even worse than what went on here, and that's a bigger market.
Yeah, it's amazing. But, you know, back to China, whenever they talk about the coal, you know, the coal car thing, they show some pictures of cities like, not historic pictures, but today. I mean, with black, you know, clouds in the over the city and stuff.
Right. Well, you know, as I said on Daily, China's not going to put back off in electric cars, even if it causes pollution, because it probably has a century worth of coal right now, and they want to get into energy independence. So, I mean, they're going to flip over to electric cars no matter how much CO2 it pumps out.
And then they're going to, you know, throw the giant switch and thank all the manufacturers for their assistance in building up their industries now that they can, now you can all leave now.
Yeah.
Or if you want to sell cars here with your names on them, we'll bump them up an 80% tariff or something. That's coming.
Right. So I don't know if you saw, speaking of Daily again, this Hispano Suiza that's going to make it to the Amelia Island.
Yeah, the thing is
Concours.
Amazing. I'm sure it's up on the screen right now.
It's 1913, I think I want to call it, the Alfonso 13. And
there were only four of them?
Four made.
And they look like Cinderella vehicles?
That's what I thought. You know, they're like pulled out of some Cinderella storybook because the coachwork on it is phenomenal, nothing short of phenomenal. And especially if you can get to some of the pictures and close up on the gauges, just the housing on the gauges, the workmanship that went into the metal surround that went into it. I mean, they just didn't snap something on there and screw it in. It was like, oh, my God, these beautiful castings that you could even just hang up on your wall practically.
And that's going to be auctioned off
weekend. It is going up for auction.
Yeah.
Exactly right. I don't know how you value a car like that from a collector's standpoint, but just from a craftsmanship standpoint, the thing's awesome. It really is impressive.
Yeah. Well, the pictures are amazing, too.
Well, you know, that might be a good segue to get into the next part of the show, too, talking about craftsmanship and building cars and all that kind of stuff. So why don't we take our first commercial break right now, and then we're going to have Jeff Lemke from Falcon Motorsports come up and tell us about this car that's in the studio with us right now. But, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. So joining us right now is Jeff Lemke from Falcon Motorsports. Great having you with us here at Autoline After Hours.
Thank you. Thanks for the invite.
Jeff, who are you and where'd you come from?
Well, wait, before we get that, let's set the stage here, because for everybody who's listening right now, we've got this awesome car in the studio
with us. Monster car.
It's a monster car. It's a sort of a dull matte black. It's been beat on. It's been hammered at the track. And when you first sort of look at it, you go, oh, that's Corvette. And then you go, no, that's not Corvette. Oh, that's Viper. No, it's not Viper. And then it's like, what is that? So, Jeff, what is that?
That is actually almost what you just said. It's a culmination of all my favorite cars of all time, and it's just kind of a cocktail of all of them in one. That's why the familiar cues are hitting you from all different angles on it.
Uh-huh. So let's back up a second.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and now I set the
Who
stage.
Who are you and where did you come from?
Right. Seriously, what's your background, Jeff?
My background is car lover. I mean, I've just been loving cars since I was a kid, and I was majorly into Corvettes when I was a teenager, and I got obsessed with them, and I did a lot of research on Corvettes and you know, became NCRS judge and worked at a Corvette restoration place, and I just knew every nut and bolt and every year that went to what and the whole thing, and it was my passion, and you know, that the love for Corvette eventually led into Dodge Vipers. I was really taken with the 1989 Dodge Viper. When it came out, it really surprised me at the show. It was a big emotional impact because that was a surprise when I turned the corner and saw that car. And, you know, from there, I did a lot of aftermarket parts for the Dodge Viper. I made hard tops and body kits and things like that. And it eventually led to this car.
So this car, this is something that you have designed completely by yourself, from scratch, essentially. Is that right?
For the most part, yeah. The theme, everything that I wanted is in this car. I didn't design everything from scratch. Like, I didn't design the engine, and I didn't design the chassis for it. It's all proven components. The chassis is a race car chassis that's been on the track for several years, 3 years, actually, and it's a very successful race car.
So is it a Grand Am chassis underneath or something?
No, the chassis is built by a gentleman in Clinton Township, Fran Hall, and he's been racing his super light cars in unlimited class on the track. And his cars have been proven out, and his workmanship is just stellar. And I was very impressed with what he did. And he actually came to me when he saw the car. And between the two of us, we put this car together.
So it's a mid-engine. What motors on it?
The motors that we're going to use are GM LS7s is the base motor, but then it's built up with a cam and a special ECU and also a carbon fiber dual plenum intake system, you know, to keep it unique and keep the power up where we want it and keep it fun.
So give us some basic dimensions. How long, how wide, how tall, how heavy, how much power, the basics.
Well, we're looking at about 620 horsepower. I wanted to keep the roof line on the car as low as possible, and it actually got a little higher than I wanted, but we're at 44 inches for height.
So that's pretty comfortable inside, actually.
Yeah, it is. You can get a pretty tall person in there. Not this particular car. The test mule car is pretty cramped, but with the actual production cars, they're quite a bit bigger. Mm-hmm. On the interior.
So 44 inches tall.
44 inches tall. It's the same width as a Lamborghini Murcielago, but I can't think of what it is. It's just short of 80 inches. I think it's 78.5 on the width, and then 175 long and with a 5-inch ground clearance.
Mm-hmm. And weight?
Weight is just under 2,800 pounds. It's an all-carbon fiber body, and it's all-aluminum monocoque chassis, which actually has some carbon fiber structural components in the chassis as well. And all the suspension components are machined from solid billet aluminum. And, you know, you could almost sell the car looking at the chassis with no skin because it's just a gorgeous piece of jewelry. I almost wish I could have brought one of those, but...
Now, you showed it at the Detroit show in a copper color. That was your show car, right?
That was actually the first customer car. That car is sold, and that's headed to New York.
Really?
That car is, it wasn't complete at the auto show. In fact, that's a story in itself. We had to rush it there at the last minute. I didn't sleep 60 hours before it got to that show, and I was about to fall over. But... No, I mean, we literally just kind of had panels resting in place for the show, and then when we, you know, get it back to the shop to finish it up. And but it displayed well, and it was a pretty big hit. People loved it.
So does the it's with the owner in New York already?
No, not yet. We're still finishing the car. It's back at the shop. It's all dismantled. Okay. We would have brought that one here today, but it's, you know, it's not even as put together as this car right now.
So 650 horsepower, you said?
620.
620, mm-hmm. And 2,800 pounds. I did the math earlier today. That's about 4.5 pounds per horsepower.
Yeah.
Which tells me this thing is blisteringly fast.
Absolutely. No, it is fast.
What kind of gearbox?
This one's housing a Recaro 6-speed.
Nice.
From the Ford GTs. It's just a wonderful gearbox. I mean, they can handle a lot of power and... you know, they shift really well, and it's just a great transaxle. They're in limited supply, though. They're running out of Recaro transaxles that are available, so we're actually having one made for the car that's almost a duplicate of that.
Huh. What kind of brakes?
We're using StopTech brakes that are tested out in California. They're actually the brake system. What led me to those is I loved the brakes on the SRT10 Vipers. I just thought those brakes were amazing. And these are the brakes that they use on the ACR, I believe, mm-hmm. for the Viper.
So when did you sit down to actually pen out the way this body would look?
Well, it's funny. I'm not a very good sketch artist. I can do...
Wait a minute, you're the designer.
I am the designer, but I have it all in my head. And when people would ask me, you know, what's this going to look like? And I'd sketch it out. And, you know, well, good luck with that, Jeff. And I said, no, it's really cool, but it's in here. And so I actually had to create it in foam. And so I sculpted the driver's side of the car in foam. And then I think people were starting to get the idea of what I was going to do.
So you just, machined out this foam? Or?
Yeah, just sculpting. Sculpting tools and sanding and you know, the
but
whole thing.
But if you
thing.
Make a mistake in foam, that's it. You start over.
Yeah, right? Well, yeah, foams and fillers. And yeah, that's true. I mean, we filled it up. But it was a crude model. I mean, it was fairly accurate. But once it was in foam, then it was digitally scanned in. On the driver's side, and then I worked with the surfacers, and we finished off the surfacing of the car on the computer, and then flipped the other side, and then had the models machined out.
Uh-huh. So, and it's a metal body?
No, it's all carbon fiber.
Oh, really?
The entire car is carbon fiber, yep.
Wow. So, and you fabricate this all yourself?
Yeah, we build all the molds in our shop. Manufacture
Wait a minute,
the
tell
panels.
Us about your shop, because
so that's, about,
that's pretty good when you start making your own molds.
So that's Falcon Motorsports. I mean, you've been in business doing, you went from body kits for Vipers to what?
To this car. This was... You know, we still do the products for the Vipers. We still build the hard tops, the three-piece hard tops that we designed several years ago. They're still one of our most popular products. We still get requests for our Street Serpent kit for the Dodge Viper, which was a wide body kit where we replace all the panels on the car. And but this was our next step. I mean, we really wanted to do our own car. And this is it. We're pretty proud of it. It's really fun. I mean, it's the excitement that we were after. We wanted an extremely exciting car. And
so if you go to your website, which is what? FalconMotorsports.com?
Mach 7 Motorsports houses all of the Viper stuff. And then for this particular car, it's FalconF7.com.
FalconF7.com, and that's where people can go to order one.
You got it. Yep.
And that's what you're calling this, the F7.
This is the F7. That's correct. Yep.
So how much does it cost?
The price on this is $225,000, mm-hmm. which, you know, it depends on who you talk to. That's either really high or really low for a car like this. You know, there's people that see that different ways. And we did get a lot of comments at the show that was much too low for a car like this.
Wow. Very interesting. And how are you getting the word out about the vehicle? Obviously, you displayed at the Detroit Auto Show. That's about as big a venue as you can get. But yeah. How else have you been working on getting the word out?
Well, I'm not a great marketer, and so I hired a team of marketing people to do that. And they're doing an excellent job. And really, the marketing campaign for a car like this is more underground. I mean, to get it at the Detroit Auto Show and blast out the word is something that we definitely wanted to do to get the buzz going. But from here on out, it's going to be more of a word-of-mouth, private, individual sort of marketing campaign.
Sure. You're going after a pretty targeted clientele at that price point, even if it is too low.
Yes, exactly. You're not going to see a commercial for it on TV or anything like that. You know, even the Detroit Auto Show, that creates the buzz and it creates the hype and gets the attention of, you know, this car is out there, but that's not, you know, directed really at car sales.
So are those the wheels you're going with, too?
No, they're actually not. The wheels on the production car are actually a one-piece Forge Racing-type wheel.
Okay.
It's a little bit lighter wheel and a little bit stronger.
What's the footprint of the tires?
They're 20-inch wheels on the car, and there are 275s in the front wide and 335 in the back.
What I like about the car that you've got here in the studio is it looks a little bit battered. And, you know, as I mentioned before, you've had it at the track. So how does this thing drive? Talk about what it's like, the driving experience.
It surprised me. Because here we were, I expected it to be really crude because this is, you know, the first, you know, iteration of what's going on. And I wasn't really sure what to expect. I had the layout in my head of exactly what I wanted. You know, it was a very Ford GT in layout. And I wanted to design it based on what I knew were already great cars and kind of put those components in all the respective places for weight distribution and things like that. We've all had a lot of seat time in Corvettes and Vipers. When we first got in this car, we did a lot of road testing, and it was just wonderful. I mean, the way that it drove and handled and the braking and the acceleration blew away what we were experiencing before with those other great cars. And we knew we had something awesome. I mean, we got pretty excited about it. As far as the racetrack, my driving skills aren't exactly up to par for that. So we had a race car driver do his thing and dial in the car. And he was also very impressed with it, you know, especially right out of the box. He didn't expect it to do that well. Huh. In fact, he set his own personal lap time at Mid-Ohio the very first day in this car, and he wasn't expecting to do that, you know, without having even dialed it in yet.
Huh. What did it turn at Mid-Ohio?
He was turning 130, I don't remember, to be honest.
In the 130s.
Because when the track guys were looking at me, they were telling me the numbers, and I was, is that good? and they said, yeah, that's really good, you know, for what they were doing. So it was there were Viper competition coupes out that day, and they were turning, I think, 136, 137, and we were a couple seconds after that. Mm. So the Vipers, the competition coupe Vipers, were a little faster that particular day, but this car hadn't been dialed in yet. It was its first day out, and, you know, he said with a change of tires, because we used street tires at the track that day. There weren't slicks or anything. And he said he could knock a few seconds off with the tires alone. So,
mm-hmm. What are you doing for lighting in the front? What are you
up front here?
Yeah.
Well, there's some halo rings on there and projector headlamps, and the HIDs will be available as well, and the fog lamps, LED fog lamps.
So, how are you guys making these cars? I'm fascinated by that. What kind of operation do you have to actually make them?
They're hand-built, and they're done in stations, you know, very similar to, like, what the RT-10 Viper started out to be. You know, if you look at the Viper plant now, it's a little bit more of a line, uh-huh. an assembly line. It's still handmade to an extent, but if you remember ever visited the plant back when it was original RT-10, you know, it was station, and that's pretty much the way that this is going to go together.
And where is it made?
In Holly, Michigan, just south of Flint.
Wow. That's an amazing story that this exotic kind of a car would be made just outside of Flint, Michigan.
Yeah, that is fun. It's very exciting.
Have you mentioned you sold one of them. What's the plan here? How many do you think you might be able to sell of these cars, or how many do you hope to sell?
Well, we've got a handful of extremely interested people right now, and they want to see the final car, you know, and do, you know, a little bit of a personal sort of get together, and see what we've really got there. And we're going to have an event here in the next couple of weeks where they'll, you know, fly them in from around the country, and they'll, you know, get a firsthand look at the car and get to go through it. And we should be getting our orders and deposits after that.
And Ford made a limited number of GTs and said, that's it. Is that the plan with this car, or how long do you think this might roll for?
Well, I'm just going, by rule of thumb of, you know, shelf life on a car like this, we might get 7 or 8 years out of it. I'm not sure. But it's going to be a very limited production. You know, our plan is to do 10 or so this year and then 20 the following years, you know, per year. And, you know, that's about all we plan to do, and maybe another car in the works, depending on this one's success. I've got a few other ideas in mind, and that's basically it. We're living the dream, you know, building your own cars.
That is living the dream for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Now I see you have the struts on the roofs. There's no glass on the side or plexiglass or anything. It's see-through.
Not on this particular car. No. Only the test mule car. The production car has a vent glass and power windows.
Okay.
Yep.
And what kind of exhaust system?
The exhaust system is custom fabricated, and you know, it comes up, you know, through some headers and does a crossover into. Has catalytic converters on it as well, with the O2 sensors and, you know, all that good stuff, and then it comes up over top of the bumper. You know, sound was something that was very important to us. We wanted the right tone, and, you know, sound means everything as well.
You know it. That's very important.
Mm-hmm.
So does the front open up, or is it just dominated by the big air extractor vents?
Nope, it opens up as well. On the production version of the car, there's actually a trunk under the front, you know, just behind the extraction vents. And that's a clamshell hood in the front, which is a pretty big piece, a carbon fiber piece, but it's just nothing compared to the gigantic clamshell in the back, which is a very challenging piece to manufacture, a clamshell piece that big. I remember when the original Viper RT-10s came out, they had the largest, I think it was single-piece composite. I'm trying to think of what the story was on that, other than an airplane or
but
something.
But it was a huge piece. You're
it
right.
Was huge.
And your piece there is awfully big, too.
Yeah, I think this one might be bigger.
It could well be, and certainly looks more complicated the way that you're running the sail panels.
Yeah, it is. It's a very complex piece, a very expensive piece to build that particular piece right there, but it's so cool. Especially when it opens up and it tilts back and behind the car. It's really a showing. You know, I love being able to show just a great engine bay as well. And I remember, you know, the old Ferrari F40s and F50s when the back would come up, and it was very dramatic and just a lot of fun, and that's the theme that I wanted with this.
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't see the back. How many pipes are again come out?
Oh, two.
Just two.
Two, yeah. Yep. But it comes out, it's in line with the tail lamps. The tail lamps have a very fighter jet afterburner type rear end thrust forward sort of theme.
Cool.
It is. It's really cool.
So what do you, are the mirrors, I spent some time looking at the car at the show, but what do you do for the mirrors? Are they weird shaped or just sort of traditional?
They actually have their own unique shape to them. Obviously, the mirrors on this car are missing.
Right.
But they actually have a hook at the side, okay. Kind of. Just that little extra flair.
And as a limited manufacturer, what do you have to do? I mean, what do you have to go through to get this car approved for sale? You don't have to do all the stuff, do you? But
not quite everything. Not quite everything because of the limited numbers. But there's some things that we definitely got to go through, and lots of paperwork, and yeah, it's not easy.
Do you have to crash a car?
Not right now, no.
Oh, that's good.
But there will be a point in time.
If you build enough of them? Is
yes.
that where it kicks
mm-hmm.
in?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can imagine. Will they... Now, I imagine you've got this whole car in CAD.
Yes.
The whole thing's in CAD. So
yes.
You could actually do a CAD simulation. I wonder if NHTSA would allow that.
Yeah, I don't
because
know
the
that.
Correlation in the simulation right now is so good.
It is really
and
good.
Especially in low-volume production, it would be very inexpensive for somebody to say, here, crash it all day. Take the thumb drive here. Take the flash drive and go crash my car.
Yeah, the CAD comes in very handy. It's, even for aero, you can get really good, very accurate, feedback on aero with just the CAD as well. I mean, we would to prove it out physically. Is always good to do too, just to make sure that the computers are right. But it's an accurate thing to do.
See, that's been a big breakthrough, I would say, in the last decade and a half, because aero used to be such a black art, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody was guessing at things, and they knew some basics, of course, but they were guessing at a lot of things, and. So now there's computational fluid dynamics, which can really simulate airflow and even simulate moving ground plane the whole nine yards. It's really impressive. And to your point, highly correlated now between what you see on the screen and what you see in the tunnel or on the track.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very helpful, very helpful. And another thing about aero, based on the design of this car, my only aero concern when I designed the car, and I had to make myself stick with this from the start because I knew what I wanted out of the design of the car, and that was my only aero concern was making sure that the car stayed on the ground, no lift, and that it was safe. As far as coefficient of drag, I did want low CD numbers, but I didn't want those numbers to take away from design. Right. Design always trumped drag in this particular case, and that's
besides
why
you have 620 horsepower.
You do have 620 horsepower, but I saw the theme for all of the newer cars that are going for low drag, and they all start to look the same. Mm-hmm. I can see the similarities, and staying away from the Coke bottle shape and just things like that, and all the things that really invoke a lot of passion. And
have you looked at the new McLaren up close?
Yeah. That was actually at the MGM Gallery before the show.
Did they have the bare chassis there next to it?
Mm-mm. No, they didn't.
I wonder if you'd see the chassis. It's real impressive.
That's extremely impressive. I love it. It has the aluminum or the monocoque carbon fiber tub.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's really something.
That's great stuff. Great engineering. No, I'm impressed.
Well, you know, why don't we take another commercial break right now and we'll open it up to rapid fire and see what the audience wants to talk about as well. But, Ben, right now, why don't we give a good shout out to our friends at Chevrolet?
It was more than a car to him. It really was his baby.
Oh, no. That's my old Chevy. Dear God.
Okay, well, Jeff, this is the part of the show that we call Rapid Fire, and the idea is that we go through as many questions from the audience as fast as possible. It never works out that way. We always get hung up and got to talk about these things. But anyway, Ben, let's bring it up. Okay, Rumble Strip's got a question for Jeff. How long till you go head-to-head with Glickenhaus and his P4-5 at the 24 Hours of Nürburgring?
I don't know. That's the short answer to that question. I have no idea how long before we're actually going to be, you know, trying to beat people up on the track. But that's the intention.
That's got to be one of the dreams. Part of the dream, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. No, we want on track to prove this out and say we are serious about performance.
Fantastic. Let's see. How much of that lower profit number from China from GM is due to the fact that they get 49 cents on the dollar because of joint ventures rather than lower prices? Great point. It's a combination of both. They are selling a lot of very inexpensive cars in China, but to the, you know, the questioner's point, you know, you got to give half your profits over to your Chinese joint venture partner. Chris from Royal Oak says, why is it that other than the Chrysler 200, none of the domestic OEMs make four-seat convertibles anymore? GM used to have Saab and the Pontiac G6. He goes on to say, GM and Ford have the Camaro and Mustang, but for those who don't want a muscle car, there are few domestic options. Meanwhile, a host of foreign automakers are making four-seat convertibles, like the Volkswagen EOS, the BMW 1 Series and 3 Series, the Volkswagen C70 and Lexus IS. He says it seems there should be an opening in the market for a non-muscle car four-seat convertible produced by GM or Ford. What do you think, Peter?
I'd stick with the Camaro Mustang myself, because even if you get the standard one, it's not that. You know, I don't like calling those cars muscle cars anymore because they're much more sophisticated than that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think Chrysler's fallen in that niche by default. You know, they've been the rental car champions for convertibles. You know, they put them in resort areas. Oh, you want a convertible, and they charge an arm and a leg for a pretty mediocre car. I don't know as the GM or Ford needs to race through that segment, you know.
Uh-huh.
I really don't.
Well, you know, the problem, too, is, everybody loves to have these convertibles, but they're a hard sell. I mean, that's one reason why automakers don't do these things is it's just so hard to come up with sales that justify
GM is
it.
Saying we don't do anything now without a business case. Remember that? I mean, that's their
right.
big thing now.
Right.
Believe me, there isn't one for that, so. I kind of winced at that whole thing. It's like, yeah, give me your business cases. Let me drive a business case. That's what I want to do. No, thanks.
Let's see. What else do we have here? Austin from South Carolina, I guess, SC. He says, if you thought the Q4 results for Opel were bad, just wait for Q1 of this year. Boy, I'll bet he's right. Opel Vauxhall lost 1 point of market share over the last year in the European market. Their sales were down 21% in Europe, with 20% and 34% loss in the UK and Italy respectively, and that's just for January. Wow. The pressure's on the guys in GM. They better get Opel turned around fast, and it's not going to happen.
It's
not going to happen fast.
Because the market over there is really suffering, and, you know, you know, right now all they're thinking is, well, we'll cut costs. Well, good luck with that.
Yeah. Jim says, Peter, question, what do you think of the Volt ad where they kind of have a production line outside?
Oh, he's talking about the one with the Hamtramck commercial.
That's, could well be.
Yeah, it's a new one. I think it's pretty good. I mean, I like the Volt, and I appreciate what they did with the Volt. I think it's taken a bad rap, but I like the ad fine. You know, it's not super special, but it's good.
Mm-hmm. Ben, I see we got a phone call here. Let's bring that first one in.
Hey, guys, this is Jeff W. from Albany, New York. I'm sure you've probably heard the expression that when everything looks great, something's wrong. And connected with that, you know, how do we know that some of the recent sales numbers coming out of Chrysler are true? I mean, they've been reporting some pretty fantastic numbers lately, but, you know, I'm sure you guys all remember back in 2005, they also posted some great numbers, but now we know that they played a lot of games in terms of pumping up dealer inventory and so forth, and it was really just kind of a sham. So, yeah, I was just wondering, you know, how do we really know that the great news from Chrysler is truly as great as they say it is or not? Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, good question, because Chrysler is posting staggeringly big sales increases. But here's the deal. You can hide stuff for a little while, but you might hide it for maybe a month, maybe 2 months. You can hide it, and then it comes out. Because you've got companies like R.L. Polk that are checking registrations. And believe me, the media would be all over this. They would love to nail any car company, but especially Chrysler or a GM, you know, for the whole government motors thing. So,
you know, they're putting cash on the hoods, but not dramatically more or less than the others. And, you know, they have some good products, you know. The Grand Cherokee, the Wrangler, you know. You've got good products and they sell, you're going to get profits. But, you know, some of it, I'm sure, is they're really putting money on it.
Oh, it could well be.
Especially, I think, with the 200s. I think they're really laying some money on those.
They could. The sales are up impressively. But what we'll also see is, remember, Chrysler started out weak last year and built in strength all year long. So we're comparing January to January. They're real strong right now. They weren't that strong a year ago.
But now,
as we get deeper into this year, the increases will not be as great.
No, they won't.
But they're still doing pretty well. Yeah. They're still doing quite well, actually. Let's see here. Catalan Alex from Romania says, are there any plans for a racing version of your car? Well, actually, you had answered that. But he also asks, which supercars do you think are better than yours? A cheap question.
Yeah, it is. You know, what's the definition of better? I think there's a lot of them that are different, that appeal to different demographics. I mean, I love the new Lamborghini Aventador. I think it's just wonderful. I think it's wonderful to look at.
Yeah, it's stunning.
And it's just cool in so many respects. I love the interior. I just think it's great. On the downside of that, I don't know if I could own one because I am really a big shifter guy. I love manual transmissions, and I love a target roof. I like to be able to take the top off and enjoy a car. So for me, I don't know if I could actually own it. I appreciate it. Huge.
I meant to ask you, I mean, you're not going to have a lot of driver aids in this car, are you?
Not at all. No, this is meant to be a very just driver car oriented, and it's not going to, there are no driver aids. It's
good.
It's a very...
Now, do you have ABS brakes or not?
Yes. Yeah, it's an option. Okay. ABS is an option on this car.
Okay. That's
and
good.
Then you probably don't have airbags or anything like that, right?
No.
You don't have to meet any of those kind of safety
right.
standards.
No. We're keeping the weight down and keeping the production numbers down, and we're going to be...
Yeah. But the car is strong.
It's very strong. Yeah, it is extremely strong. It's very stiff and very lightweight. It's wonderful. I'm very proud of it. It's a great car.
Now, are you going to have regular seatbelts in it or 5-point or something, 6-point seatbelts?
Depends on what the customer requests. Yeah, they're going to come standard with standard 3-point lap belts, but If somebody wants 5 points, if they're going to be doing some serious racing, we can install those as well.
I would imagine that at the price point you're talking about, what'd you say, 225?
I think a lot of guys will want track cars.
Yeah, well, that, but I was saying, you know, it sounds to me like you'll do just about anything for somebody who wants whatever they want in this car.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're tailor-made for the individual. I mean, and we have the ability to do that, you know, at a low production, small facility like we have, and that's the fun of it. You know, that's part of the appeal.
Yeah. Hey, Ben, we've got another phone call. Let's bring that one in.
Good evening, A-Team. This is Youngblood calling from Cleveland, Ohio.
All right,
John, I think today's daily, you made a comment about how heavy truck sales are increasing, much so, signaling that the economy is turning around, which is all great news. One comment I wanted to push in there, and I don't know if you're aware of it, but in 2014, government standards for emissions take effect for the large, heavy-duty trucks. And what I'm hearing from some of the people now is that they're buying these trucks now versus in 2014, because rumor has it that the emissions-certified trucks, the diesels, are going to lose a whole bunch of horsepower and a whole bunch of torque and have a whole bunch more electronics and a whole bunch more diesel particulate filters and all that crap, and they want to get their vehicles right now before all this crap goes on them. That's why a lot of people are buying heavy vehicles now. I just thought I'd throw that in there. Great show. I love your new digs. I love that showroom there. Have a good one. Bye.
Great. That's great. Yeah, I mean, look, the heavy truck stuff is always gone through cycles lately over the last 20 years, that whenever the EPA comes out with more stringent standards, the price of the engines goes up. And so everybody rushes in to buy them before that price increase hits.
Right.
But I would say, as he pointed out, that's in 2014. That's still 2 years away. I have never seen heavy truck sales running as strong as they are running right now in my entire career, my entire life. Never seen it. You know, it was normal to sell, and we're talking like, you know, big semi-rigs, Class 8 trucks. We're talking things like UPS delivery vans, you know, from that to that, you know, those extremes. But you know, for most of my career, if they sold 180,000, 200,000 a year, that was good. That was something you could really take to the bank. We did 300,000 last year. We've never seen this kind of increase before. And heavy trucks have always been a leading indicator of the economy. So I think it's for the good. Maybe there are some people trying to buy before those 2014 regs, but look, when you even out the cycle, I've still never seen truck sales like they're going right now. It's amazing.
Speaking of trucks, when someone wants to buy one of these from you, they will come to your shop, right? But then will you ship them the vehicle, or how's that going to work?
Yeah, well, for customer number one, he's so excited. He went and bought his own custom trailer to haul it, and he wants to drive out and pick it up himself and haul it back. We can arrange shipping in so many different manners. It depends on the personality of the customer.
Okay.
Scotty in Cleveland wants to know, Peter, did you see the Saturday Night Live Clint Eastwood Chrysler ad spoofs?
Yeah, we mentioned them on the table. It's funny because people go to Out Extremis and read me. They don't understand that go to On the Table, there's more. And go to Fumes, there's more.
There's more to your website than just the homepage.
But yeah, it was. I saw those, and they were fantastic. Bill Hader made up like Clint, and they did three, and each one Clint goes off the reservation even more than. And I think the first one he says, "What car is this for again?" Oh yeah, Chrysler. Then by the end he's saying, "Get off my lawn." And it was really hilarious.
From Gran Torino.
Yeah, yeah. It was really hilarious. But people, if they want to watch them, they can go to the website or go to YouTube. Really well done.
Okay, Eric Ambrose wants to know, Jeff, with an independent pushrod suspension, where are the coilover dampers located?
On the rear, they're located horizontally about the height of the tire inboard.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's actually some photos on the website where you can see some of the pushrod suspension.
And the front?
And the front is not pushrod. The front is standard coil.
Oh, okay.
Coil over.
Okay, Frank wants to know, where's the startup money for a car company like Jeff's come from?
Well, that's a lot of hard work, and it's actually our own funds. I mean, we funded it, and, you know, we feel it.
That's a good way to put it.
You've obviously developed your expertise in working with carbon fiber over the years.
Yeah, yeah. And it's from our, you know, buildup of the businesses that we've been doing for the last 20 years, and it's just our own investment.
This goes back to our conversation about convertibles. Mike DeWight says, why not a C-Max convertible so that Ford can out-weird the Murano Cross Cabriolet?
I actually think Ford's going to do well with that C-Max.
Yeah. Oh, I do too, yeah.
I mean, people kind of walked by it because it was by the Fusions at the Detroit show, but I think they're going to do very well with that and the Escape. I think the new Escape's going to be big.
I do, too. What do you think of the Murano Cross Cabriolet?
Well, I wrote a column about that, which it's terrible. It's just terrible.
I haven't driven the vehicle, I have to confess. I'm dying to drive it. I really am. I know everybody hates it, but I'm dying to drive it. Hey, we got another phone call here. Ben, let's bring it in.
John, this is Dave Britton, Fort Wayne, Indiana. I was wondering why none of the automakers are making light-colored interiors anymore, especially in their convertibles. It seems like the cars that are convertibles, they always seem to have a black interior, and that's the worst thing for somebody that's had 13 convertibles in their life. So just was wondering, what is it with interior colors nowadays?
Well, actually, the Murano, what is it called? Cross
Cabriolet.
Cross Cabriolet has all kinds of sunshiny interiors because when you drive them, you lose your mind. So they have all kinds of light interiors. You can get light interiors in the Chrysler.
Yeah, but, you know, I think his point's generally well taken.
Well, when you live in hot climates, you know, it's nice to have a lighter interior so you don't, you know, fry your ass every time you get in the car.
I know, but I'm down on interiors in cars because you get black, beige, or gray, it seems, and that's it. I mean, I still think the industry is missing out big time.
Oh, I agree.
In having great fabrics, great patterns. I mean,
well, they do them on the concept cars.
Yes, they do.
But they don't.
Yeah, because that's the designers making the decisions, right, Jeff? And then it gets to production, and the bean counters go, no, this has to be polypropylene.
Yeah, no, I mean, you see it in the concept cars. It's not like they don't think about it, mm-hmm. but then they don't execute it. It's just like, well, see, if we add a fourth interior color, it's like the guy in the office. That movie, I'm sure everyone, I don't know, you know. I think you ought to just go back to do your call reports and don't add another color.
DC Auto Geek wants to know, Jeff, what cars do you own and what's your daily driver?
Yeah. Well, right now my daily driver is a GMC full-size pickup truck. And I actually had quite the collection of Corvettes and Vipers and things like that, but they're all gone right now, sold off. It's part of my investment to build this car here.
Good. Okay, AG4, question for Peter. In Europe, Opel competes with Ford. Does this mean the higher trim Fusions, a.k.a. Mondeo, will compete with the Buick Insignia, a.k.a. Opel Insignia?
I don't know if Opel's going to be competing with anyone over there.
Well, I think what he's asking is the Insignia. Yeah, right. Sorry. Here I am trying to explain to you.
No,
you're making
okay.
a sarcastic comment.
That's okay.
So you think Fusions will compete with the Buick Insignia?
I think the Fusion is going to lay waste to a lot of cars
when it
hits the road. I mean, I think GM would want the Buick, you know, to compete, but I don't think it will.
Okay, we have one more here. Jim wants to know, when Fiat North America reintroduces DeSoto, Plymouth, and Dodge heavy truck to the market, will they be with standalone dealers or added to the Dodge, Chrysler, Jeep, Ram, SRT, and Mopar dealers that already exist? I know I left out Chrysler Military Tank and Travco Motorhomes, but I didn't think those would be relaunched right now.
Awesome. That was good.
That's pretty good. Well, hey, folks, I think we ought to wrap it up here. This has been a pretty interesting show. But Jeff, especially, it's been awesome having you here. You know, we love cars. We love car people. And when people can build their own cars, that's the most awesome of all.
Out of pure passion.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
The way it should be.
And do it yourself. It's brilliant. You know, much success to you. I hope you guys really do well because it's so cool.
Thank you.
And Peter, great having you here again, as always, too. It's really good. Want to thank all of you who have been watching. Remember, you can always follow us at Facebook or Twitter, or you can go to the Auto Extremist because there's more to that website than just the homepage. Or you don't have to do any of that stuff. You can just listen to the podcast and enjoy that. And don't forget to just look at our website. Is there a roundabout tomorrow night? There is a roundabout tomorrow. So check that out on our website at autoline.tv. And thanks, everyone, for having tuned in.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at autoline.tv.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion. And by Chevrolet. Chevy runs deep.